WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Novelist Rob Forman Dew's territory is the family. Her first novel, Dale Loves Sophie to Death, was about the world's last happy family. It won the 1982 American Book Award. Her next novel, The Time of Her Life, was about how family members unconsciously hurt each other. In her third novel, Fortunate Lives, she returned to the happy family of her first novel, only to disrupt their lives with the death of the youngest son in a car crash. Now Rob Forman Dew tells part of her own story in her new memoir, The Family Heart. It's about how her life was changed when her older son, Stephen, told her he is gay. The revelation first threw her into a state of grief, but that was transformed into anger at a society which could discriminate against her son. When her son broke the news, he was a sophomore at Yale, home on a break. This is how he came out.
Well, he was on the phone talking to a girl I thought he was involved with, a young woman. And suddenly I simply said, I realized there was no sexual tension between them, as you hear between adolescents. And I said, have you been involved with anybody since high school? He was a sophomore. And he looked very irritated by the question, as he should have. It was absolutely none of my business. And he said, there's something I've been meaning to tell you. And I listened for a minute. And he said, I think I might be gay. And a parent doesn't want to hear that because there's a huge range of things that happen to you after you get this information. And I tried to change what he said. I said, oh, you think you might be gay? And he said, no, what I mean is I am gay. And we took it from there. I gave him a hug. He gave me a hug. And we moved on. That was the beginning of a long process. Not too long, but longer than it should have been. Longer than I hope it'll be for anybody else.
It sounds like you have a pretty tight-knit family. But did it make you feel, when your son came out, did it make you feel like maybe you didn't really know him at all? And
absolutely.
Did it change your image of him?
No, it didn't change my image of him. But I think this is particular to each family. I did feel foolish on one level that I had not. This is a person, and along with his brother, whom I thought I knew better than any other creature in the world. I thought I knew everything about him. I don't mean intimate details. I didn't think I knew. I didn't want to know who he was dating, or I no wanted to know. But it was. I knew what wasn't my business. But I thought I knew everything essential to his happiness. And here was this enormous burden of secrecy he had carried in order to make us happy as parents, and that broke my heart.
You know, you had an image of him as being someone who was just beloved by everybody. He did
golden.
Great in school. He, I think, was a good athlete as well, and, you know, his teachers liked him. He had friends. And now you suspect that he might have been terribly lonely in one respect.
Yes.
During his school years.
Oddly enough, it was the idea of his high school years that I had the most trouble with, because he was so successful, and I think a lot of his energy was driven into being a summa cum laude graduate of his school and a class speaker and a peer counselor. And interestingly enough, his school will not welcome him back. That was very hard. I thought, will people now withdraw their friendship from him? And it's a testament to him. He's a remarkable person, and his brother is too. It's a testament to both of them that people did not withdraw their friendships from him.
Did you ask yourself if you did anything?
Of course.
That led your son to be gay? Like if you were a domineering mother. Yeah, a suffocating mother. That's a very popular image.
It is, unfortunately, horribly popular. Oh, sure. In fact, I dreamed it. I dreamed that I went into my son's room when he was sleeping. And he was, in my dream, about 8 years old. And I said, I think I forgot to tell you about sex. But it was very clear in my dream that he didn't need to know this. And I agonized about what might I have done. And then I thought, wait, I've only done something wrong if being gay is wrong. And I had never actually believed that being gay was wrong. I'd never thought about it much. And I knew there was nothing wrong about my son. So I guess maybe really only for about 20 minutes did I seriously wonder if it was something I had done. Because once again, when you say if it's something I've done, you're talking about a flaw. And I really never did see him as flawed.
Is there anything you said to your son after he came out that you wished you hadn't said?
Oh, yes. At one point, I was trying to persuade him to tell his brother, who was graduating from high school that year, and Stephen quite rightly said, I don't want to tell Jack now. It will make his graduation all about me. And it's not about me. And it will also make him very uncomfortable, I think. I mean, Stephen was afraid he would lose his brother, maybe. He wasn't sure, but he thought it wasn't the right time to tell him. This made me feel as if we were conspiring against my younger son. And I said, at one point, I was struggling for an analogy, and I came up with possibly the worst analogy I could have come up with. I suddenly said, well, Stephen, this would be like, it would, for Jack, if he hears this from your friends, I mean, it would be as if, and I was still struggling, and I don't know where this came from, and I said, it would be as if he found out you were, a mass murderer. And I've never seen a look on anyone's face that hurt me more than realizing what I had said to my son. And I desperately tried to amend that. But you can't. I don't think Stephen will ever hold that against me. And in fact, even at that moment, I could see him starting to forgive me the minute I said it. And although he was angry, thank God.
Your son told you after he came out that you could ask him any questions and he would answer them. Were there questions that you asked that, in looking back, you shouldn't have, or questions that you wish you asked, but you didn't?
I wish I had immediately asked him, explain to me what this means. Explain to me, is this different, or do you know if this is different? How can I imagine your life? Because when finally I did ask that question, he said, I don't see. He clearly didn't know this was something that was baffling to me and my husband. So for a long time we didn't quite understand what I was trying to ask. I didn't understand it, and he didn't understand it. And finally he said, you don't have to imagine my life any different than you always imagined it. I want what you want. I want to love somebody who loves me back. I want a committed relationship with someone. I have work I really want to do. I don't understand how people work when their emotional lives are in chaos. I want what you want. I want to love someone who loves me back. That's all I needed to know. But I had bought into the whole idea of, And I say this with some hesitation because I don't know that I really had bought into this idea about any other gay man, only when suddenly it was my own son. Every stereotype I'd ever been faced with hit me, the idea of the insatiability of gay men, which is a ludicrous idea that I had never paid any credence to until it was my own child. I don't know what triggered all these fears.
Rob Foreman-Dew is my guest. Her new book is called The Family Heart, a memoir of when our son came out. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Rob Foreman-Dew. Her new book is a memoir about when her son came out. When your reaction switched from a sense of grief to a sense of anger at the inequities in society, you and your husband became activists. You became active in a group of the parents of lesbians and gays. And then you started to think, well, maybe you were becoming activist at the expense of your other son. What happened there?
Well, life is very complicated. I mean, I've discovered it's You know, Terry, I really thought that I was going to get to a place where it would be very calm to be an adult. I'm 47. I've gone through the civil rights movement and the women's rights movement, and I thought, oh, now I'm here. My children are grown. We suddenly became obsessed with this issue, particularly after the Republican convention and the Pat Buchanan speech and various other speeches and remarks. And we became so obsessed. I was phoning people constantly. I was phoning columnists and saying, you've hurt us deeply. I lost track of my other son, and you can't do that. You owe equal attention to all your children. My other son was also a real advocate for his brother, especially until we became such active advocates. And then I think he had his own life going on. He was starting his first year of college. We simply assumed, which is something I've learned never to do, never assume anything. We assumed he knew that he had our ongoing unconditional love and affection. And he knew that, but he needed to talk to us about some things of his own that had nothing to do with gay and lesbian issues. And we failed him for a while. I think we're all learning constantly. We're coming back together. We are back together.
What happened to make you realize that your other son had felt that you were withdrawing, focusing all of your time on gay rights activism?
Well, it was really an awful moment, and also a transcendent moment, and an absurd moment. My son goes to college, my younger son goes to college in Connecticut, and he decided to stay that summer after my older son came out and work in at school. He had been working at Wesleyan, and he decided to stay and live with some friends and work there. And he was back and forth. He called one day. I was trying to get ready for a dinner party. It was very hot and sticky. He called from Connecticut to tell me that he had had a flat tire and that he was at a filling station. And I got very cross. I said, well, Jack, you have my car. You're in Connecticut. What can I do about this? Call AAA. And he said, well, that's why I'm calling. I don't have my AAA card. And I was really very cross. I said, well, how could you leave the house without your AAA card, you know? And he just suddenly, there was a sort of intake of breath on his end of the line, and suddenly I could hear traffic going by. And I realized he was calling me from a filling station or somewhere probably on the interstate. And he finally just said, Mom, I almost killed myself when this tire blew. You didn't even ask. If Stephen had called, you would have been worried about him. But you didn't even ask. And then he was talking over tears. I burst into tears. And I asked him to please come home. I said, I'm sorry. There's nothing I can say but that I'm sorry. I'm absolutely wrong, and we love you, and I hope you'll come home this weekend. And he did, and we started building again. This is still a rather sensitive issue. I think Jack probably feels that we're overly paranoid, and we may well be. I think even my older son thinks that maybe we could be a little less activist. But once we got involved with PFLAG and were on the helpline, we're getting some pretty desperate calls from teenagers whose parents have absolutely rejected them. They're homeless. They sometimes have been beaten up by their own parents. And these are children, not children, young men and sometimes young women who easily could have fought back. It's very endangering to an ego of anyone to have a parent attack you physically. And unfortunately, this is often one of the reasons that happens.
It sounds like the family you've created is a reasonably happy family,
mm-hmm.
a reasonably close-knit family. But from what I've read about you, you didn't come from a happy family.
Well, that's true. The family, they were all so interesting. The people, my mother and father, were fascinating and quite brilliant. They really weren't very happy married to each other. My father was an alcoholic, which is always a problem, and an entire system of, well, it shapes the family in ways that have now become almost everyone has been reading about them. But when I was growing up, no one did. This was considered a character flaw. And my father was dangerous when he drank. But I loved both of my parents, and both of my parents loved me. I wanted them to love each other, and I think they sort of did, but they also sort of didn't. It was tiring. I was tired by the time I grew up, and I really thought I would get to rest. Now I don't think I want to rest.
Did growing up in a fairly unhappy family make you more confident that you wanted a family of your own? I mean, you seem so family-oriented now.
I know. I think that's probably, it's probably some sort of psychological term. I think it's compensatory family-making. I don't know. No, In fact, I was terrified when I was pregnant. I thought, what am I don't know what to do. I have no idea what parents do. But it really is a pretty natural thing. And in fact, my parents were very good. They meant to be very good parents, and for the most part, they really were. They were really hard on each other, and I think it was really hard on my sister and me to see them so unhappy. And we felt like we constantly had to protect them. But I think when I realized what was possible, that it was possible to have emotional stability and really to love people unconditionally, that's when I think my life became bearable. I had really thought often about, I had been in really great despair during part of my life and had not thought actively about suicide, but had wanted to sleep desperately and twice had stolen pills from my father, taken them, and luckily they didn't work. I wasn't trying to die, I just wanted to go to sleep because I didn't want to think and have to be responsible or worry or be sad.
You know, you write about families all the time in your fiction, and in one of your novels, a son dies, and it's obviously really tragic for the family. Did it frighten you to kill off a child in one of your novels? Did you feel like you were tempting fate and something terrible might happen to you in real life as a result?
Absolutely. In fact, I had to wait until my children passed the age of that child before I could finish the book. It was awful to write. And I suppose what I was doing was contemplating my worst fear and trying to understand how people survive having their children die, because I see them do it with grace all the time. And I think I wanted to figure out how.
Did you start behaving differently around your sons when you were writing Fortunate Lives? Did you start to... What was the difference?
Well, for one thing, whenever I'm writing, I behave... It's very difficult probably for my family, although they're endlessly patient. But I became so protective or so worried about them all the time. In fact, that was the year my older son had gone off to prep school in New Hampshire, and I was working on this book, and I heard a report that there was a sniper at... I was listening to the radio, and it was horrible. There was a sniper at a college somewhere who had wounded or hurt someone, and I immediately... There were no phones in the dorms where my son was at school. There was a phone in the dorm, but you could never get it. So I called and asked him to leave an urgent message for Stephen to call me, and he called, and I said, Stephen, you absolutely must come home if you hear there's a sniper on campus. And he was just... He said, well, okay, I will. I mean, I was just sort of a mad woman about safety. I mean, I was constantly telling them things like, how to exit buildings if fire started. And I think they were so glad when I was through with that book. They both read it and they both like it. I don't think they quite understand the passion of parents.
You have a passage in your new memoir that I found both very moving and kind of funny, too. And you're talking about all the superstitions and rituals parents will go through when they feel that their child might be in jeopardy to kind of do right by fate.
That's right.
And your example is of a friend who, whenever her child is on a plane coming home from a visit with his father on the opposite coast, what does she do?
She scrubs her entire house. And I know just exactly, she's
a wonderful
parent.
What's the point of scrubbing the house?
Well, if she has any fun while her children are in the air, I know she feels that somehow they'll take her children away from, the plane will crash, because how dare she have fun while her children are in jeopardy? Now, her children are getting older, too. All of us do this. I'm sort of starting to grow out of it.
What do you do?
Well, what I do is wear my opal earrings, which I have on right now, actually. One of my children is traveling right now. They're really not even pretty, but my children gave... I was born in October, so opals are lucky for October. I mean, of course they're not lucky. It's a superstition, but... And of course I'm not superstitious, but I'm wearing these opals. I wear these whenever... I've sort of extended it now. It's not just my children. Anybody I love or care about who's traveling, I put on these opal earrings, which when a friend of mine recently flew to Australia was really painful because they're not comfortable to sleep in. But they work. The planes haven't crashed. So I should knock wood now.
Right? So you have to sleep in them too, huh, to make
yes.
this work?
Yes, you can't. You can't let yourself off the hook. If you're going to be superstitious, you've got to sort of follow through with it. But, of course, I mean, we all know, all of the parents, my friend who's scrubbing her garbage cans with bleach knows that on some level, because she's a brilliant woman, she knows that is not going to keep this plane in the air. But on the other hand, she's not going to take any chances.
Your children are adults now. Do you still feel that it's, do you still feel as scared and superstitious about their safety?
No. No, that really does wear, that wears off. After a while, when you see them being competent adults, and they certainly have been competent adults, the idea of your responsibility for their happiness wears off. And in fact, you come together as good friends in a way that I hadn't known would happen. Now that they're responsible and leading lives that I admire and that seem exciting to me, I don't feel quite, although I do have these opal earrings on, don't I? But even so, I don't feel quite as responsible.
Rob Formandoo, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
It was a delight.
Rob Formandoo recorded in May. Her memoir is called The Family Heart. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.